welcome to a new edition of Nationalist Public Radio. I'm James Price, here today with Brett Stevens. We are covering an interesting timeline right now, to say the least. It looks like the end of the world. We have what is essentially a killer bat flu that is potentially going to be recurring and mutating over the years, which we can only hope for a less lethal form. We have riots, we have an election coming up, and we have all kinds of question marks that we were going to be covering today. So why don't we just start this by turning this over to Brett. Brett, why don't you just give us sort of a 360-degree view? Where's your mind on this? Where have you been taking this with America for the past weeks?
The question is, what is the historical cycle in which we find ourselves? Because that's going to tell us where we're going to go next. To my mind, this historical cycle is late-stage democracy. The crises we see right now are in themselves not entirely tragic. They are not civilization enders. However, our inability to get on top of them is indicative of the end of a civilization, specifically how democracies end. And we can tell that's the case because we have no solutions that we will accept that are actually going to do anything other than repeat the same problems we're having now. So we are in that end cycle where we've tied our hands and we can't really change anything, but we keep doing the same dumb stuff and getting the same dumb results because we are thinking in unrealistic ways based on what is required to succeed socially, economically, and politically in a democracy. And as a result of that, we are repeating the same patterns from the past, getting the same bad results, and then coming back to the table and saying, wow, we should do something different, but we can't because all of it's taboo. For example, we believe that we must have diversity, that we cannot ever change anything about the composition of our society. We believe that we must have democracy everywhere and weak government and more laws and more constraints and more bureaucracy, and yet that's not working for us either. And finally, we've got the system of globalism, which officially failed with the coronavirus because China both lied about the virus and then showed that it was unwilling to provide for us the gear we needed to fight this pandemic. We are in this cycle where we have all of these methods that we're committed to using, and none of them will bring about anything that's going to address the problem or fix any of these issues. That's the end stage of a civilization. Generally, when that happens, whatever regime is in power is quickly going to be not in power because it has demonstrated that it can't fix these problems, that they are going to be intractable and eventually wear it down to the point where it's going to collapse. We know we're in a collapse state. Most of middle America is slowly waking up to this, and they're starting to realize things like that no matter how much we crack down on the cops and no matter how much we try to stop the diversity problems, they're always going to be there, and they're going to be so problematic that they're going to end us. They're starting to come to see that, and they're losing faith in the system just as people did in the Soviet system in the late 1980s, and that means that regime change is upon us. Whether it's going to be mild regime change or something more extreme is yet to be seen. It could be something Trump can patch up and can convince people to drop enough of our bad laws that we might be able to continue. But in a broader sense, we're seeing the end of the post-war period. With the world wars, democracy won out. That became liberal democracy with civil rights, European-style market socialism where you tax the heck out of everybody and then you redistribute that to your underclass so they don't revolt. And that's been consistent now for, 75, 80 years, but it's starting to slip. And as it's slipping, people are losing faith in it. And as people lose faith in it, it's not so much that they're going to act against it, but that they're not going to keep fixing its many problems. Instead, they're looking toward the future. They're saving their time, money, and energy to apply to something better that they think is coming. This is typical of late-stage democracy. If we follow the model of Athens and Rome, there's going to be some sort of massive conflict that is going to drain us. There's going to be internal conflict and small civil wars. And then there's going to be an economic collapse, which drives away anyone with any potential, followed by a social collapse, and then there will be invaders. That's the bigger picture. What I would say matters most to us now is figuring how we can stop that from reaching its extremes and simultaneously guide it away from repeating the past. That is a tall order, and I think people are afraid of it, which is why we are still stranded in this perpetual sense of being unwilling to act. Everything feels surreal, as you said earlier. We know there has to be change, and yet we can't quite envision it, And so we're sort of in a state of extended anxiety. And this was revealed by two relatively minor events. COVID-19 is not something you want to get, but it turns out that it infects relatively little of the population and that it tends to kill very few of them. So it's something we could survive if we manufactured our own stuff, if we had good leadership, and if we weren't dependent on China for certain things. And I think that is one of the biggest influences on how people's minds are changing.
Touching on two things you said, we're basically dealing with multiple crises simultaneously right now. And I think it'd be naive to say that anything really has to do with that of George Floyd. We could say that it was a catalyst which set everything off, but I think that all the issues that you put it is that this was basically exacerbated by COVID, and then we just realized the failings and the trappings of democracy. And then we have this event, and this is just where the social fabric just snapped, basically. Where we go from here, so far as civil war, I'm sure a lot of our readers are probably have their skepticism of that. Some of them are probably awaiting that. But looking at this, I would imagine that for it to come to that point is we would have to reach the level that we thought we were going to be at when COVID started. This is when people were basically raiding shelves for basic staple foods, raiding shelves for toilet paper, chemical cleaners. But basically, after this happened, our supply chain adjusted. And so for this to happen, we would have to realize basically a complete logistical breakdown. We would have to actually realize what we suspect would be a recession into a potential depression. Because if you look at real inflation right now, it's not very encouraging. I guess what I'm saying is I can buy part of this. I can see the potential for that. But I also see the fact that we were pretty close to coming to this with COVID. Nobody anticipated it getting this bad. So my question to you is, do you think we're on a realistic timeline, let's say 1 to 3 years out, to actually realize something like this, some sort of event? And do you think this might be exacerbated should Trump win re-election?
Oh, well, I'd hope so. Trump winning re-election would signal many things to the left about how they're losing control of the narrative, and the left is basically responsible for this regime. We are a leftist regime at this point. Sure, we've got some conservative holdovers, but for the most part, what defines our society is that it has leftist values and leftist assumptions, at least on a political level. Trump winning shows that populism is replacing liberal democracy as our ideal. And that means that how we interpret the events and the choices we have in liberal democracy will also reflect more of a populist slant, as opposed to going more left. And that means the left would be in full freefall. They would be actually losing power because they would have lost the battle for hearts and minds. I think Trump will win, barring some major crisis, and it's going to drive them a little bit mad. The main thing that that would do, just like COVID, just like the George Floyd race riots, is show us how fragile this system is. When a major election becomes a crisis for people, meaning that they have an emotional, moral, spiritual crisis, whatever it is, in response to it, that means that they are investing way too much into politics and that politics is way too divisive for this society to have any unity. When I talk about the Roman and Athenian models, those societies tended to die by 1,000 cuts. They'd start a number of little foreign wars. They'd have smaller civil wars. I'm not talking about the big boogaloo. I'm talking about local outbreaks and political crises in which we see a consistent pattern where people are geared up for a major division in the society. There have to be at least two groups fighting each other, and the two biggest groups have to somehow define a schism on some fundamental question about our society. The question that we're going to face is civil rights. Do we care more about taking care of every individual, or are we interested in a social order based in natural order, natural law, that kind of thing, where the good get rewarded and the bad get moved on? Fundamentally, what defines something as leftist or liberal is that it's egalitarian. In an egalitarian society, you try to make sure everyone is taken care of because everyone is equal in your ideation. We are moving away from that with populism. It's going more toward your Reagan and traditional conservatism idea, which is that you care about making sure the good people come out ahead. And when the others have bad outcomes, you say that's too bad. This is the way America has been during most of its existence. We just have not cared as much about people who are not succeeding. That sounds callous, except that you realize your other option is to enslave the productive and good and moral to all of these people who are failing without creating a corresponding duty to the failing people to stop failing. And that's where we are now. A third of everything we do is wasted by the civil rights, affirmative action, diversity, etc. payout. That has to do with both class and race / ethnicity. For class, we've always been talking about the poor and how we should take care of the poor, and that's the root of most egalitarian leanings. There's some people, they're marginalized, they're excluded, they're not thriving, they're impoverished, they have no power, no one cares socially about them, that kind of thing. As we gear up toward these Civil War days, I think you're seeing more of a split in mental allegiances, where one group cares about making sure everybody's okay, and the other group just cares about making sure that normal, good people get rewarded, and to hell with everyone else, because they'll drag us down into the abyss. That's, I think, the Civil War-type ideation you're seeing playing out.
You mentioned that the right is shifting more towards populism, and I think it's always safe to say that our version of the right is always shifting towards populism, and always. But in the situation of the mainstream right now, I'm still sort of seeing the opposite right now. If you want to consider the Republicans the mainstream right, which I guess would be the most common to say, is that right now they're basically operating on the idea of inclusivity right now. The populism they're going for is more of a civic populism, right? They're trying to say, okay, everybody, no matter what race or creed you are from the Democratic Party, you're welcome over here, you can embrace our ideals, and as long as you can do that, you can be an American, you can be a Republican, you can be right-wing. That's one part where I digress, is that I see basically an olive branch going out. What happened with George Floyd, obviously, I think we agree, was not ideal, but then again, it was from a broken system, the events that ultimately led up to that. But what we're seeing in reaction to that is solidarity to come together as a people right now. We're not really seeing what I consider populism amongst one groups of people. This is where my skepticism comes about. Are we going to become a right-wing party of following similarly to a Stalinist social stratification model or hierarchy in that? I don't quite see it, just because you were mentioning entitlements. Right now, I don't know if our readers have been reading the CARE Act, but I'm sure everyone has probably got their $1,200 stimulus check by now. My understanding was that there was another one well on the way. And then just behind that, almost everyone in the country is expanded to unemployment benefits, even if they're self-employed. And something like this has, at least in my lifetime, it's never happened before. If you're self-employed making $1,000 a month, and you apply for unemployment, you can get another $600 on top of that. I'm not promoting this. I'm just saying that in terms of entitlements, this is available to everybody. Because of this, I don't quite see it all transpiring in this way. When you say the right, Brett, which right are you talking about? Are you talking about the mainstream right, the Republicans, Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell party, or are you talking about sort of the fringe right, our right? Because there's a lot of different actors at play here that make this up. My read on it is that there are moderate Republicans right now that I think have become distasteful of Trump, and I want to be optimistic to think that he can win re-election, but my sense of it is that this is unpredictable, and it's just as unpredictable as it was in 2016. What are your thoughts?
We have a couple things in play here. One, incumbents tend to win unless they do something truly terrible, and Trump has focused on the number one thing of importance, which is it's the economy, Stu. And that's why he's willing to undertake temporary Keynesian measures, such as these stimulus payments. None of us like the idea of a socialist stimulus, but we have avoided a permanent UBI, and at the same time, we've avoided a market collapse because everyone would be bankrupt. He's keeping America spending, and he's so far managed to avoid the new Great Depression that people were saying we were going to have. So far, it's working. He's focused on one thing, and he's doing it really well. And I think his thought is, whoever comes out of COVID-19 with a strong economy is going to be your last man standing, is going to dominate the new world economy. China, I think, whether they planned this or just capitalized on it, realized that they were going to be able to wreck most of the world's economies and therefore bump their own up and take over a bigger share of the world and the world economy. the U.S. has tried to steer its way around that. He's done a good job, and I think he's in the best position possible, barring any real surprises. He's also demonstrated a great deal of acumen in foreign policy, in that he has navigated all of the quagmires successfully. He's got all of the bad guys sort of at arm's length, and he's managing to keep stability in the world with a decreasing U.S. presence, though strategically, he intervenes sometimes in ways that probably are more ballsy than anything Obama ever contemplated. It leads to the bigger question. I mean, you asked who is the right, and I think that is the vital question. My answer is that in politics, as in economics, the real game is to capture your silent majority. America is built on people being here and supporting the nation so that they can live a decent, comfortable middle-class lifestyle. That means they have a nice house in a nice neighborhood. Doesn't have to be fancy, but it has to be nice. Their kids don't get assaulted on the way to school. They have functional cars, they have retirement funds, and they have enough time to enjoy life. And that last one, I think, is the biggest sticking point, because as you can see with Obamacare, for example, so much pressure was put on people to generate extra income that a lot of that free time went away. Those were the days of the side hustle. Obamacare came in and suddenly everybody had an Etsy shop or was selling crap on eBay or whatever. So I think the silent majority is the real target, and I think the right, as I express it, is the people within that silent majority who are interested in a right-wing style approach. And the real problem with them is that often they don't come out to vote. They're not inspired by the candidate. They don't like John McCain. They think Mitt Romney's a wimp because he backed down off the 47% comment. Any of that stuff, and they're going to back away. But I think this group fundamentally is right-wing in that they like the idea of rewarding the people who are functional, of sticking with the things that have worked, of not trying to fix all of the problems of nature with government interaction and payments and that kind of thing. And I think they are the target audience that fundamentally the right needs to address. And this seems controversial because we're taught to think of the right as the Republican Party. But as I see it, the Republican Party is a service provider to the right wing within the silent majority. And they get it partially right enough most of the time. They've cruised for too long on the idea that, you know, we're simply not leftists, therefore we're a safer option. The left is now cruising on that idea because there's a lot of people who want to go back to the 20th century order, who want to go back to liberal democracy, who are terrified of the idea that we might have a real change to populism, stronger leadership, we might get rid of entitlements, that kind of thing. But the fundamental audience of the right wants something functional for the good people, and they are skeptical about most of humanity. They've been suppressed for a while. You know, you talk about the mainstream right and how they're compromising. I think their nature is to be administrators and managers first, so they're always going to try to make the system work if they can. And that's just like having an office job. You want to get along with your colleagues, so you don't want to rock the boat too much. But I think rocking the boat is upon them, and that's what they're not quite realizing, and that's upsetting them. But the thing is that with this rocking the boat come more options. We might be able to get out of this dead-end cycle where we keep doing the same things, they don't work, so forth and so on. So I think the mainstream right will upgrade following the audience. I think the audience is defecting to populism at a certain rate, but there's a faster rate of them losing faith that we can just keep doing the same stuff as we were doing and have life go on as normal. We're $25 trillion in debt. Our country is on fire from race riots. We're still not sure if the coronavirus was an actual threat or a media panic. And so we don't trust anything. There's a lot of fear and trembling out there because we no longer have a unifying culture. We're starting to see the effects of what Robert Putnam wrote about, how people just hunker down and stop giving a damn about what goes on beyond their doors, and therefore society careens straight into the toilet because no one's watching the road ahead anymore. Everyone's just like, oh well, it'll just keep maintaining itself, I don't care. This has gone on for a long time. William F. Buckley, in the 1960s, basically neutered the Republican Party. He turned them into Christian libertarians. He said, we're going to give up on race, we're going to give up on heritage, we're going to give up on social class, and we're going to give up on fighting domestic communism. What we're going to focus on is winning the Cold War. And I understand why he did that. Like a good CEO, he was saying, we're going to streamline our operations so we can deliver the maximum amount of force on the thing that we need the most. And that was great. We saved the West from communism. But in doing so, we also saved our domestic leftists, most of whom are pro-communist in the same way that the peaceful protesters have no problem with the violent looters, for the most part. They're just providing cover for them. He took conservatism to being Christian libertarianism, and that meant that it couldn't talk about issues like race, it couldn't talk about social class, and it couldn't talk about a world without leftist-style entitlements, civil rights, the idea that we take care of everybody, all of that stuff. It was an egalitarian version of conservatism, and that got us through, but then backfired, because fundamentally that version of conservatism is a variant of leftism. It's the same problem we had with National Socialism and fascism, and the same problem that we do have with libertarians. Classical liberals and people who want ultramodernist societies based on the leftist state fundamentally agree with the left, and that means that they are going to get assimilated. And the Republicans definitely got assimilated sometime before the Obama years, such that they were offering the same things that the leftists were offering, just with a slight conservative flavor. But nobody wanted that, because if you're going to get free money, you might as well go straight to the source and get it without any corresponding duty to yourself. That means it costs you nothing, it costs someone else something, but you get all the stuff and you don't have to do anything that's inconvenient for you. And that's where we were. Trump followed Farage and a bunch of other changes we saw in European politics and on the edges of American politics, where people were saying, this is no longer working. We keep applying these leftist solutions, and they keep failing. That's how the silent majority, the conservative part of the silent majority, and a good deal of the moderates, who are the real swing state in any American election, as far as I can tell, that's causing that group to move closer to populism.
I would also echo that since the Tea Party, 2016, part of the base that got Trump elected, I guess you could say, was our brand of the right. However, our brand of the right didn't really have a brand. We identified it mostly by a value system, which is we don't want diversity. We want hierarchy and we want ecology. And so basically what we saw at that time was then we had the emergence of the quote-unquote alt-right, which is probably a fair topic to bring up right now about what's actually happened to that then. But the community we had back then, not a lot of it still exists right now. Last I heard of people like, let's say, Richard Spencer or Taylor being on a podcast or something. It's been quite a while. So my question to you is, we can acknowledge that on the right, we still have this silent majority acting sort of in the background. And then we have sort of the fringe elements that sort of try to inspire them, try to make them understand. And so my question is right now, what do you see for the future past a late stage democracy? Like what sort of do you see the world as sort of being a place where we can basically mold it as a ball of clay at this point and just say, look, this is what went wrong. You can listen to us or not, as we've been doing right now. What sort of reality do you see playing out in that? And most curiously is what timeline? Because I would say that there are many times, especially from, as you mentioned, national debt, which is going to get even worse right now, and Trump will be forced to take on more socialized entitlements as well to handle the situation, especially if he wants the economy to win re-election. So in my mind, we're just getting started. I've seen many symbols that indicated the end of late-stage democracy. Right now, you're really convinced that this might be the final catalyst that actually gets us there, and I'm inclined to agree. My question is, what do you see rebuilding it looking like?
Let me first address the alt-right. I'll tell you what killed the alt-right. They could not come together on the question of socialism. We had National Socialists and basically mainstream Democrats who didn't like diversity coming together with old-school conservatives and libertarians, and we could agree on a few things. One was that we didn't want more Obama. Another was that we didn't want another Bush. And so we could come together on this platform of saying, like, look, we no longer want the moderate right, and we no longer want the socialist left. But beyond that, and opposition to diversity, there really was not much tying the alt-right together. And I think that it's gone into a period of senescence because that golden moment where all of our interests overlapped really sort of passed. I think a lot of people are doing great. I think Richard Spencer continues to write and speak. So does Jared Taylor. They have their audiences, and those audiences pass the word on to others. We're realizing, after Charlottesville, that the alt-right can't really do demonstrations and can't really centralize. Anything we centralize on is going to be destroyed by the left.
Don't mean to interject, but I'm sure you might also agree that the tactics of Charlottesville is sort of emulating a leftist model, protesting in the street. I don't think it's something that has historically been becoming of the right. It's not the type of approach that we usually take for reform, the Charlottesville approach. Would you agree that that was a leftist tactic and probably a miscalculation?
It's hard to say it was a miscalculation. I think it was something that needed to be tried, which was getting real visibility. What Mr. Spencer sought to do was bring in a group of nice-looking young men who are articulate and clear about what they believed, and have them show America that the face of the alt-right is not weirdos in basements. It's your sons, husbands, brothers. It's normal, middle-class American men and women who wanted to come out and say, we've gone too far to the left, we got to swing back to the right. It didn't backfire so much as it was sabotaged. There were two elements to this. The first, obviously, was that in Charlottesville, the authorities wanted to foment chaos. So they steered the alt-right guys straight into Antifa, and naturally bad things resulted. And they got a few convictions of that. You know, they let the crowd beat on James Field's car. He drove into some other car. Unlikely he really meant to do that, since he obviously took great care in his car. And someone died, possibly unrelated, possibly by being hit. Who knows? Charlottesville is run by leftists, so it's very hard to trust anything that comes out of there. The second thing that tore it up was that it fundamentally didn't have unity, and a lot of people were just in it for their personal popularity. They were out there to try to make money off their YouTube channels and to follow the great dream of being an iconoclastic right-wing speaker who suddenly attracts all these people and sells a book or whatever and gets rich and goes off to not worry about any of this stuff ever again. Which, I understand the appeal, I just don't think it's what we need right now. So the alt-right fragmented based on that. As far as is marching in the streets a leftist tactic, well, yes, but we're in a leftist system, democracy, and the media is super important. There's a bigger pitfall there in that I think white nationalism self-destructed because, in part, it was captured by the media. The only way you got ahead as a white nationalist was by getting a bunch of guys in uniforms to get out there and scream offensive things such that the media would cover you. The more outrageous, the better. And so that drove us straight into Hollywood Nazi land. And those people, of course, the media loved covering them because they were comical. You know, they basically made the leftist point for them. You say, oh yes, all these Nazis are crazy people. Watch. And then out come the Nazis and they scream racial epithets or Heil Hitler or whatever, and everyone's like, oh, I see, it's mental ward day. And so that really backfired there too. And I think the alt-right was trying to evolve a different strategy. The 1900s strategy through the 1940s was the Klan. You joined your local Freemason-style organization, and it worked behind the scenes to try to keep order and maintain the social order as you knew it. That ultimately failed with the civil rights movement. Well, then people went to what I'm going to call Rockwell-style organizations. You had uniforms, you signed up, you went on marches, you did all of this stuff. They were emulating the fascists and National Socialists in the 1930s. That didn't work either, because the media doesn't like that, and because they were fundamentally preaching a message that was hostile to America, which was still thinking it had done the right thing in World War II. So it just looks like you're sympathizing with the defeated at that point, and I think that pretty much took care of them. They also were relentlessly compromised, because once you have a membership list, the feds will pay a lot of money for that. It just takes one guy with a drug problem or a divorce, and that list is going to be in federal hands quickly. That movement went away, that style of movement. What Mr. Spencer wanted to do was get a group out there, have them look normal, have them look nice. And he quickly realized that wasn't going to work, I think, after a rally in Michigan, because it attracts too many detractors, and they're going to get the heckler's veto, because they're going to burn down the town. He correctly realized, I think, that he didn't want to be seen as the instigator of riots. So he took the alt-right into a senescent mode, which also enabled it to try to get some unity on these topics. The real fight right now is going on social media like Gab. It's going on these little blogs and these little podcasts where people are slowly coming together to figure out what they believe. And the biggest stumbling point is the socialist issue. There are some who want UBI-style market socialist entitlements, and there are others who do not, because they realize that once you bring any part of leftism in, you're going to go fully left. And so you have one group who's just saying, America as it is would be great if we just didn't have the diversity. That's true, but it's also not a complete answer. It's a necessary part of the answer, but it's not a sufficient answer. The other group is saying, we just have to get as far away from the left as we can, and that means we have to drop them economically and socially. This enables us to differentiate ourselves, so when separation does come, it's going to be very clear who belongs where. Then you're going to end up with some very leftist coasts and a middle of the country that is going to go increasingly to the right. Once we get a few steps to the right, people tend to go all the way to the right, and they'll even go further than fascism and National Socialism towards something more like what's actually going to get us out of this modern problem, which is monarchy and traditionalism and feudalism and other things that recognize the need for social hierarchy as well as the need for economic hierarchy. You asked about timeline, and I have to say that's very hard to anticipate. Almost all estimates of timeline are wrong. There are so many events you depend on, little stepping stones, that it's really complicated math, so to speak, and I just don't think it'll be done right. This coming election will be crucial because we're going to get some answers there about whether we're an underground movement or not. 2030 is a break point because we're either going to have been swamped by demographic replacement or we're going to have reverse demographic displacement and begin the swing back toward the opposite direction. Most white people, using that white definition loosely, are comfortable in a nation of 80 to 85% white people, because that means that although the election can be swung by minority votes, it's generally going to go in favor of what white people know to work. That being somewhere in the range between Clinton, JFK, Reagan, and Bush 1. Somewhere in there is the sweet spot for most voters. We're hoping to push them farther. It may be that if there's an upset in the next election and in the election following, that will actually further the marginalization and improve things, the same way that the Obama presidency improved things. I'm hoping we get Trump in for a second four-year term so he can continue packing the courts with conservative justices and can continue undermining many of the legal and political theories behind excessive regulation and how our government has behaved. In his second term, he has nothing to lose, and he'll be able to achieve a lot more. His first term, he mostly spent fending off the left by distracting them with absurd public stunts while he did things behind the scenes that they did not understand. In the second term, he's going to be able to do all-out war. He has nothing to lose. He has everything to gain. And so I'm hoping that will be one of the major factors that determines how things are going to go. Another question is what's going to happen in Europe. Brexit is still ongoing. We're seeing across the board that people are defecting from liberal democracy, and these ideas tend to zip back and forth across the ocean and intensify with each trip. It's like people are on a cruise ship talking about it, and they get all worked up, so when they finally arrive at the other shore, they're much more extreme than they were when they left. So I think that's going to influence a lot of things. We don't really know where we're going to be at this point. The question is whether we want to survive. We know how late-stage democracy ends. We know roughly what it looks like. We know that we can make the choice to just go out that way. It, after all, is not very socially controversial to say, well, let's just keep supporting the system and the way we've done things for the past 50 years, even if it's failing, because you're not saying anything controversial. You're saying to people, everything's fine, it'll work out, don't worry about it, you know, just keep doing your stuff, buy your stuff, go to your job, you know, beat your kids, whatever. And I think people like that message, because it tells them that they don't have to change. But at the same time, I think change is upon us, and if we decide not to go down the late-stage democracy path, we're going to see a populist revolution similar to Brexit, in that we're going to be disconnecting from globalism, we're going to be disconnecting from leftist ideological programs, and we're going to be getting rid of a lot of laws, or possibly changing their interpretation through the courts, but hopefully getting rid of them. If we can get some Republican majorities in there who are willing to do the difficult thing, which I think they might because it's going to be the way they're going to actually define themselves as different from the rest of the herd, we could possibly remove some of the really destructive law we have. Number one on the chopping block is the 14th Amendment. It's bad law. It brings in civil rights. It makes us a modern Soviet-style government. It's a terrible idea. If affirmative action goes, if birthright citizenship goes, if any of these pillars of the leftist machine go. I think we're going to see the leftist machine start to collapse and implode, at which point you're going to see a massive popular flight to the right because everybody wants to back the winning horse. Once the left is revealed as weak, they start to not look like the winning horse. For a lot of people, this week was that. They saw America burning and they were like, okay, whatever this civil rights nonsense is, it's not the winning horse because it results in my city's burning. But that requires a bit more perception than most people are capable of. We're looking at that kind of shift, and we're looking at going toward a West as an intermediate stage where there's stronger executive power, meaning the president has more power and there's less bureaucracy. He acts more decisively, so do the people under him. There aren't these many layers of rules and managers and stuff to sign off on things to protect people from the consequences of their actions. And I think that's something we're going to see rising. We're also going to see more of a libertarian-style economics. Like you were hinting, we're heading for default. We never could afford these entitlement programs. We can't afford them now.
Yes.
After COVID-19, we doubly can't afford the damn things. We are broke.
We're already seeing it. Right now, you could look at one of our largest buyers of treasury debts was China, past tense. They hold debt, but they are not increasing it, and we want to sell a lot more of it. So, not a good recipe. Not a good recipe for success right now. Especially for the entitlements that we're going to have to make to spend our way out of this.
My favorite potential entitlement is reparations with repatriation. I would like to pay everyone who is not a WASP to go home to their native lands. Let them take the wealth they've earned here. Let's shake hands on it, say there's been historical wrongs on all sides. What we're going to do is end this like gentlemen. And I think that is on the table, because I think people are tired of diversity holding us back. And especially as we look at the prospect of a war with China, having race riots means we can never win. I mean, the Chinese have been cheering on these riots. Their media have been publicizing them. We are not going to win if we have diversity. We're also not going to win if we have entitlements. 1940s America was a much more fascist, and the thought back then was, make yourself useful or die in a ditch. And most Americans agreed with that, especially coming out of the Great Depression. They're like, you have to contribute, produce, create, or you're useless and you're working against us. We got out of that because when we were riding high after World War II, we had all the money, we had the most functional economy. We thought we could just keep doing it forever. Turns out we could never afford it. The entitlements have to go. The socialism has to go. Though this issue split the alt-right, I think it's a winning issue for the right, because people are tired of the free riders, and they're tired of all the political instability it creates, not just racially and ethnically, but in terms of social class. We can no longer afford to be buying off the proles, and instead we need to drive away the people who are causing problems and keep the good ones. And I think you look at your average middle-class guy who's come home from a long day of work, and he's like, yeah, well, I'm doing my part. Why the hell isn't everyone else? You know, we understand if you're out of work or if you become sick or injured or if there's a crisis. You know, of course, that's what the coronavirus stimulus is about. When things go badly, we're all willing to dig deep and lend a hand. But we've been doing this as government policy, following the socialist model for a long time. Civil rights has made it a legal obligation and basically a property of poor people that they're owed money. And we've been adding all these entitlements and government programs. We never could afford them. We're in debt. We're headed for default. So I think that's on the chopping block, definitely. People don't realize it yet. It seems insurmountable now, but in times of radical change, things that seemed like common sense become alien very quickly. That's what our future would look like. Stronger executive, more capitalist economics, more libertarian, more Austrian, less trust, if any trust, in diversity and globalism, and a strong swing back to social conservative ideas and behaviors. We're already seeing that in aesthetics and behaviors. People are saying, you know what, this sexual revolution thing has burned out on us. Everyone is suffering. Young men can't find wives. If they do find wives, they just divorce them for the free alimony welfare until they die. People are having horrible trauma from their sexual experiences. Even sexual assault's gone up. I mean, all of these things are raging out of control. The pendulum's swinging back. But the bigger point is that I think the people who are alert don't want a pendulum swing. What they want is to get out of the system entirely. We don't want a leftist system. And we're now willing to sacrifice sacred cows like democracy and diversity and say, you know, we meant well. It doesn't work. These things don't work. As I see the near future, if things go well, you're going to have a stronger executive, more libertarianism, more social conservatism. And I think you may actually get the ecological revolution you're hoping for, because we are having a pollution crisis that is far bigger than climate change. The faith in climate change and that religion is falling, because people are looking out there and saying, look, we can't find a single sea turtle that isn't full of plastic. We can't find a single square meter of ocean that doesn't have a Coke can and a condom on it. We are realizing how dangerous that is. We're also realizing this was one of the great things that COVID woke up, that air pollution makes us weak and it may kill us. You know, the areas where people are dropping dead tend to be polluted areas, because that's the equivalent of smoking 2 or 3 packs of cigarettes a day, except that you're smoking cigarettes made of car exhaust instead of delicious tobacco. So the big point is this, and I can't emphasize this enough, the post-war order has failed. The order we embarked upon in 1945, liberal democracy and all the other stuff we brought in with it, including diversity and civil rights, that isn't working. Consumerism isn't working. The strategy whereby we tax the hell out of the people who are productive and dump money on everyone else so they all run off and buy iPhones, that's not working any longer. We're going to transition into possibly just an age of skepticism of all the things from the 20th century that are no longer working, but maybe we'll go further. Nobody expected Brexit to happen. No one expected Trump to get elected. We're in a time of radical sea change. That's the future I hope for. If that doesn't come about, if demographic replacement works its evil magic, if the left resumes control, then we're going to go into the late-stage democracy scenario I mentioned. There's going to be endless infighting. Everyone's going to be selling everything on the black market, just like the late years of the Soviet Union. No one will trust the government. It's going to become a joke. You're going to see people hiding all of their tax income and stockpiling weapons and doing their best to get out. Well, I think you're going to see normal people doing this. I went to Academy. They have a great gun counter there. And I was seeing normal guys work a normal job, probably fairly pacifistic, mean well. The kind of white guys who are just always there to change a tire. They're just very friendly. They don't think of themselves as racist. They're buying guns and they're stockpiling food because they're realizing that even if a crisis doesn't hit us, we're in the hands of bad and crazy and stupid people. Their solutions don't work. So we're going to have to do for ourselves. And that means, on the flip side, we're going to have to hide as much of our income and activities as possible. Cannot trust the government, cannot trust the media, probably can't trust most of your fellow citizens if they're leftist. So I think there's a great defection from the post-war order going on now. If we're able to affect change, that doesn't go to a bad place. If we can't, it is going to go to a bad place, but it's going to be a long time coming. I'd say 20 to 25 years. But I think those are the two paths we have.
I was going to echo all that, the last comments you made about people retreating off into the woods with guns and food, I think the coronavirus is basically a catalyst for this. There's going to be a massive exodus from the city, and basically this is creating a paradigm shift onto middle-class homeowners, landowners. And especially, there was a bit of research by Gartner about a few weeks back, and it said that most workers right now, they're all working virtually. Right, everyone's telecommuting right now. And it's saying that even after the worst of the coronavirus is done and realized, that almost half of them will still have a system in place where they can work from home. And so what does this translate to? It means that more people will be incentivized to be reclusive. They can go off into the sticks. They can build their own house. They can have a farm, wife, and kids. They can work in that element if they so choose. Basically, this gives us the recipe we need for a stronger family unit to breed more independence among people and to create an actual element of social conservatism. So I feel like, you know, cities, high density, that is sort of the crux of modernity right there. And now we're going to see, my estimate, in a much shorter timeline, in the next 3 years, we're going to see a lot of distressed real estate in city centers across the United States. Probably not just here, probably even Canada as well and other places. People are going to be retreating more. It's going to sort of be like the way development transpired in the post-World War II era, right? All these little housing communities that look like something out of Edward Scissorhands or Pleasantville. That's what's basically going to become the norm again, I think. I think that people are going to retreat further away from cities. I think they're going to start to develop more outside of that. And I think even if Trump does not get re-election, but I'm still fairly confident he will, this brand of the right that you so mentioned, in that timeline, we could potentially see that. It's as you said, when you're seeing your cities being burned, from within, when you see entire livelihoods being lost, right? So when most people are living paycheck to paycheck and they have less than $1,000 in their bank, as over 50% of Americans do, I think that this is going to lead to much more than a rejection of liberalism. I think it's going to lead to a rejection of consumerism as well. Those are my closing thoughts on the matter.
You're completely correct in that people are heading to what I call the homestead, which is how most people lived a century ago in America. You had a house with some farmland and a garden and some animals. You repaired your own tools, you grew or produced a lot of your own food, and you would make things for yourself and your neighbors. You'd brew your own beer, your own moonshine, make your own tobacco, that kind of thing. I think we are heading away from consumerism, in part because people are seeing the overhead is just too expensive. We'd rather have more time with our families, spend a third of our time on the day job, a third of our time mucking around the homestead, and the rest of our time with our families and friends and communities, and possibly religious practice. So I do agree, I think that's happening. The main thing I would add here is that I don't actually view COVID-19 and the George Floyd riots as crises in themselves. I think what they were was revelations. They showed just how weak our system is, just how miserable people are, and exactly how fragile the whole interrelated thing is. Sure, we could get the food and toilet paper flowing again. No problem. But we're not going to forget the fact that when a minor disaster hit, all our neighbors were beating each other up over toilet paper and burning down their cities just because there's no unity. We don't trust the media. We don't trust the government. We don't trust academia or science. We have no one to trust but ourselves. And we would like to just cut all that stuff out and go back to basics and just lead decent, productive lives and let everyone else go home to their third world countries and let China collapse on its own and stop trying to support the poor here and maybe move them on if we can, because we are interested in success and in people who are willing to succeed. And that's what made America great. It's what made Western Europe great. And so I agree. I think there's a quasi-agrarian drive to the homestead, which is causing a lot of this. And I think the bigger thing, more than just that people were working from home, was that they worked from home for a while and they found that they liked it. A lot of people at least did. You had more free time. You were surrounded by your family. There are just many good things involved with that that break out of the mold of commuting and buying stuff and, you know, talking on your iPhone constantly or whatever people do these days. So I think you're right. I think that's a really good analysis, and that is going to signal a lot of the social change we see in the future.
This is another Better Late Than Usual episode of Nationalist Public Radio. This is James Price, Brett Stevens, signing off.
Oh,